Our speaker this morning is Father Martin. Would you like to help me welcome Father Martin?
Hi, everybody. My name is Marty Maleski, and I'm an alcoholic. My home group is Amherst Schneider down in Cheektowaga. Why they can't name it the Cheektowaga group, I don't know. But I love them very much, and they have supported me for these last 7 years that I've been living in Buffalo. It's a great joy to be with you at the closing of your 25th Lakeshore District's conference. I want to thank Bev, June, Johnny, Nancy, Frank. I think it was Dan who got us organized in the back room, and Bob. She says Bob. Okay. He won't get a resentment. He's worked the steps, you know. And all of the other men and women who work so hard to bring us together, to celebrate what our higher power has given us. I want to apologize to all of you who think that you've been listening to my tapes for lo these many years. My name is Martin Xavier Maleski, B-A-M-A-M-Div, Ph.D., of the Society of Jesus, A.A., Al-Anon, Overeaters Anonymous, and CODA. And I'm not that Father Martin. His first name is Joseph, so God bless him and his ministry at Ashley Treatment Center and the wonderful things that he has done. One of my first exposures to the wonders of the video transmission of our message was to watch his chalk talk at a treatment center down in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and I know what a great ministry it is. And on that note, I'd like to just say hello to all of the people in tape land who are listening to this tape. Our hearts go out to you wherever you are, however it is that you've come into possession of this tape. We pray for your swift and complete recovery from whatever ails you, for your comfort in your sorrow, for joy and delight in your higher power. And I regret that you people out in tape land can't be here today, because there's a lot of stuff that you're going to miss. You can't tell that I'm wearing my Superman uniform. It's blue with a red cape and a big yellow. I stand 6 feet six. I have shining black hair. About 220 pounds, all muscle. Somebody said yesterday, how can you tell when an alcoholic is lying? You can. Oh dear. The folks out in tape land can't see my lips moving. I began my life in Alcoholics Anonymous through my Al-Anon illness. There was a good friend of mine in Toronto. We were both American citizens living here on visa and studying at University of Toronto. And I want to thank all of the taxpayers of Canada for our education. It was an incredibly generous arrangement and a really wonderful, wonderful time. But Brian and I were guitarists in the same folk group, and we'd worked up in Richmond Hill at Daybreak, a community for the handicapped, fallen in love with the same women there, so we had lots to talk about. And I loved him like a brother. Really enjoyed his company. And Brian kept getting drunk and getting arrested. And this bothered me a lot. So I began to talk with Brian about his drinking. And we did a little study. And we figured out, through reading some literature, what would be a rational limit for a guy his age and weight. It would be a beer an hour. And that meant that he could go study and work and come home and, as Johnny described last night, around 7 o'clock, open the first bottle and get that that sense of ease and comfort which comes from taking the first drink. Then he could have another one at 8, 9, 10, 11. He could go to bed at midnight and get up the next day and be healthy and happy. That's what we thought. But the trouble was, Brian would come home from school and from work and open his first beer around 3 minutes past the time he walked through the door. Get that sense of ease and comfort which comes with taking the first drink. And then he'd be so relaxed, he couldn't see why he shouldn't drink every beer in sight. Which he did regularly. So, being an unrecovered Al-Anoner, I figured I could save him. That it was okay for him to get drunk. I said, look, the next time you're having a good time, just give me a call and I'll come collect your car. And that way you won't be able to get in trouble. So a few days later, telephone rang, 11 o'clock at night, and Brian said, it's me. I'm in a bar down on Spadina. I'm celebrating. I got my license back today. So I went down and had a few beers with Brian and his newfound friends. It's one of the things I loved about drinking was the fellowship. Anywhere I went in the world, I could find friends just by drinking and perhaps sharing a few drinks. I drove home under the influence, and the next morning I was buttering some toast and trying to get the day in focus, and the events of the night popped into my head, and I realized that the spot where I had parked his car was empty. I went and called him and said, oh, Brian, I'm so sorry. Somebody stole your car last night. And he said, that was me. I got arrested last night for walking while intoxicated. I keep a key under the hood. I came out of your house. I took it home when I got out of the drunk tank. He says I was still drunk. And I drove myself home. So that was the bottom. It was so shocking to me that he could behave this way, that I went to my bookshelves and pulled out a little pamphlet that I had set there months before. In January of 1981, a pamphlet was written by a Jesuit, and it was mailed to all of the Jesuits in the United States provinces. And it was all about alcoholism. And this pamphlet explained how alcoholism starts small, and it spreads. Early on, if you could recognize it, that it was alcoholism that was beginning, it'd be easy to stop. By the end of this progressive disease, anybody can tell that the person is an alcoholic. Little kids on the street can smell them coming. And it's very easy to diagnose the problem and very hard to reverse the effects of the drinking. So the theory of the pamphlet was, just like with cancer treatment, catch it early. Cancer starts with one little cell that's got a bad idea. And if you could catch and destroy that one little cell, it wouldn't take much, just go, pfft, gone. You would spare the person a lifetime of suffering. But it's very hard to detect. As our illness progresses, the symptoms, the clues that show us what we've got get stronger, easier to read, and harder to reverse. And when I had read this pamphlet in January of 81, I said, wow, this is an important, really important idea. I'd better keep this pamphlet, because, you know, priests run into alcoholics all the time. So in April, I made an appointment with Brian for Friday the 24th at 3 p.m., and I took down the pamphlet. And I started to work the steps for the first time in my life. I admitted that he was powerless over alcohol. Came to believe a power greater than him could restore him to sanity. And made a decision to do so. Being a person of the old-time religion, I moved immediately to the fourth step. In the old days, they didn't delay. You couldn't get into a meeting without working the first three steps. Your sponsor would take you upstairs, get you down on your knees, make sure that you were powerless over alcohol, made sure that you had some concept of God, made you say the third step prayer. Then you'd be led to your first meeting. And immediately after the meeting, you'd begin working on your inventory. So I took out the open to the part of the pamphlet with the 20 questions. Do you drink alone? Yes. Feel guilty about your drinking and have tried to stop? Yes. Have you had people coming to you, talking to you about your drinking? Yes. Have you been institutionalized because of your drinking? Well, not me. But Brian had. Yes. You know the whole list. And as I was going down this list with Brian, he was peeking over my shoulder. And he's looking at all of these yes answers that I had ticked off when I had first read the pamphlet. I'm an active reader. I underline things, I write notes in the margins, I use different colored pen, you know, so that I can remember what it was that struck me the first time, second time, third time through. And when I had first come to this page in the pamphlet, I had checked off seven yes answers. And then I turned the page and saw the grade scale. It's the stupidest grade scale I've ever seen. If you say yes to one question, you could be an alcoholic. If you say yes to two, you probably are an alcoholic. And if you say yes to three, you pass the test, you pass the test. Now, when I was a kid down in the States, you had to get 70 or 75 to pass the test. I know you have a different monetary system here in Canada. It's when I was in college here, it was around 50%, I think, was passing. But this is ridiculous. 3 out of 20. I mean, like, that's nothing. And so what I did in January was I mentally erased all of the clues, the symptoms, which showed what was wrong with me. The only mistake I made was I didn't erase them in the dang book. They were, all those check marks were still there when Brian was peeking over my shoulder saying, "Whose symptoms are those?" I said, "Well, they're mine, but you're worse than I am. You've got lots more." I only had one person tell me that I drank too much. And it was a girl. So she didn't count. She was the first woman that I met when I went to college. I had a crush on her, and after a few weeks of what I thought was a perfectly wonderful romance, she said, "I noticed that you don't smoke pot with the other people here in the debating society." I said, "Yeah, that's right." And she said, "Well, how come you drink so much? What distinction are you making between getting wrecked on pot and getting wrecked on alcohol?" And I said, "Well, alcohol is different. In fact, I went and did a Bible study on it. Even then, I was a pious baby. I found a scripture verse, Psalm 104, that says, 'God gave us bread to make our hearts strong, oil to make our faces shine, and wine to make us glad.'" God wrote it. I read it. That settles it. She dumped me. She said, "You drink like an alcoholic." And I really resented that because I had only been drinking. I mean, heavily drinking. I mean, drinking so as you'd notice it. For a few months. I know I had my first taste of alcohol when I was a kid, 7, 8, 9, 10. My parents would have parties and leave the glasses around overnight. And I can remember going around and sipping the different glasses to try to figure out what was this magic potion. And it was awful. It was horrible. Just dreadful. And now I know why. The ice cubes had melted. And I hate watery alcohol. My dad offered me beer and wine as I was growing up, and I refused it. One of the symptoms is there unhappiness in your family due to drinking? And I had said yes to that, and ticked it off. And the unhappiness, in my opinion, was from Dad's drinking. Wasn't my drinking. And I didn't want to grow up to be like Dad. So I was very careful about not drinking with my father until I turned 16. Then I began to have a glass of wine, a bottle of beer. But I kept myself under fairly tight control for the next couple of years. I graduated number two in my class. I got to be valedictorian. got all kinds of academic awards, president of the debating society. And the day after graduation, I was out in Paul Sowitz's dad's bar. I think it was called the Blue Water Inn in Lackawanna. And his dad had this little champagne fountain. And I discovered it was just so much fun to stand beside the fountain and fill my glass and empty it, and fill my glass and empty it. And every now and again, some waitress would walk by and pour another bottle of champagne into the fountain, and I'd pour it into me. And it was that magic moment that I've heard about so often in the rooms, where I felt the power of alcohol. I was released from being a goody two-shoes. I was free from the constraints of my upbringing. There was a young woman there sitting close by, and she was wearing what we charitably call a miniskirt. It really was about the size of a hanky. And I said, gee, I'd really like to slide my hand up her skirt. And I did. And I said, I don't care what her boyfriend thinks about that. And he is sitting right there watching the whole thing. Now this was a long... this was a long time ago. In a different world. Today, if I survived the beating from the boyfriend, I would be hauled off to court for a criminal offense, taking indecent sexual liberties. And it's really only in the last couple of years of my sobriety as I've shared the story with people, because I wouldn't think about it if I didn't have to. How this reveals my relentless self-centeredness and the character defect of lust. All I cared about, as Johnny said last night and other speakers have expressed in their own way, was myself. What I felt like doing to this poor, innocent, scantily clad young daughter of God. I didn't care about her. I didn't care about her boyfriend. I didn't care about the day before or the day after. I was living in the moment, and living in the moment strictly to please myself. And I'm very sorry for that, for the hundreds of thousands of self-centered decisions that I've made through the years. And this woman is on my amends list. I don't know her name. I repressed that right early on. And I'm banking on purgatory to finish the ninth step. I know this is a spiritual program, not a religion, but I just got to get that little thing in there. I do want to make amends to her and to all of the men and women whom I have offended. So I had only been drinking from graduation day till about middle of September. I mean, really getting drunk. And Mary Ellen said that I was an alcoholic. I drank like an alcoholic. And I didn't listen to her. When I celebrated my 10th anniversary of sobriety, I sent her a little note saying, 20 years ago, you were one of the first people to add to my symptoms list. And I'm very grateful for that. And I'm sorry I didn't listen to you. Boy, am I sorry. She was the first woman from Boston College to go to Harvard Medical School in about 50 years. She's married to a doctor. They have three kids. They're living in Atlanta. You know, she's everything you could want in a wife. Rich, intelligent. Oh, yeah, beautiful, right. Living in a warm climate. There's a little part of the big book that, for me, sums up the nature of our illness. Men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. I loved being out of my mind, crazy drunk, having the constraints of morality fall away, so that I would say things and do things that I ordinarily wouldn't do. One of the questions on the symptoms list is, do you hang around with inferior companions when you're drinking? I did. They were all Jesuits. But they were the Jesuits that I hated. They were lazy, self-centered, vulgar, impious. They were full of resentments, hostility, anger, bitterness. And the trouble was that to get to the beer, I had to be in their company. My heaviest drinking days, when I felt most guilty about drinking and tried to stop, were when I was teaching in Manhattan for a couple of years, part of my training as a Jesuit. We had a little refrigerator for like a half a keg of beer, and the keg was open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I would often go down when we had hamburgers or cheeseburgers for lunch. I'd go pour myself a little cup of beer, come back after school and have some more beer, maybe play some chess with one of the other faculty members. 5 o'clock every day, 7 days a week, we would have what we call pre-prandials. I think out in the world they call it happy hour. They bring out the liquor. And I would mix drinks for myself liberally by hand in these... we were into recycling before it was popular. These were recycled... jars, would you call them? Glasses. They were containers for holding a vigil light. Now, I can see there are a few Catholics here. That's a candle that you light and it stays lit for 8 days. And there's one period in my time in Manhattan where I was worried that I was drinking too much milk. I am highly skilled at suppressing the truth about who I am and what I've done, where I'm going. And that power, that mental capacity to suppress the truth was with me probably before I took my first drink and has survived every day since I stopped drinking. They say it's cunning, baffling, powerful. It's permanent, progressive, and fatal. We suffer from a mental illness, this disease of denial, that we don't want to know the truth. And we are very capable of suppressing the clues which point to the truth. To them, their alcoholic life seems the only normal one. They are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again experience the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once in the early stages of alcoholism by taking a few drinks, drinks which they see others taking with impunity. After they've succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, and the phenomenon of craving develops, they pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. I did that. Every year, Lent would come along, a very special and holy season for Catholics. And I'd say, this Lent I'm not going to drink. Nothing. Not a drop. But you know, Sundays aren't part of Lent. I've verified this several times. You get out your calendar, you count from Ash Wednesday to the Saturday before Easter. There's a lot more than 40 days in there. You got to subtract the Sundays to get down to 40 days. So I would go from Ash Wednesday to Sunday and binge on Sunday in honor of the Lord's resurrection. And then every Lent, it doesn't matter how much Easter moves around back and forth, every Lent, St. Patrick's Day is right smack dab in the middle. And I feel a religious obligation to get smashed. On St. Patrick's Day. My mother was an O'Shaughnessy, you know. Yeah, I'm a member of the CIA, Catholic, Irish, and alcoholic. Emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to drink again. This is repeated over and over. And unless the person can experience an entire psychic change, there's very little hope of his recovery. Because of Johnny talking last night about studying the big book, I read a little further past this paragraph this morning, and I found a thing that warmed my heart, and I hadn't noticed it. On the other hand, here comes the good news, and as strange as this may seem to those who do not understand, once a psychic change has occurred, the very same person who seemed doomed, who had so many problems he despaired of ever solving, suddenly finds himself easily able to control his desire for alcohol, the only effort necessary being that required to follow a few simple rules. So all we need, folks, is an entire psychic change. Woo-hoo! This is great. Where do I get one of them suckers? Walmart, Kmart. The doctor just kind of slips that in, you know, as if you can just pull this down off the shelf, you know, write a prescription, go down to the drugstore, get an entire psychic change. This is the work of God. And one way of looking at the big book is that it's all about God. We suffer from a mental illness, which in combination with our peculiar physical nature, we are bodily different from other people, produces this repeated behavior. And the only thing that we know of to heal the mental illness is conscious contact with a power greater than ourselves. On April 24th, 1981, I accepted the fact that I was an alcoholic. It was my first step. I resented it. I was embarrassed by it. I wanted Brian to stop drinking. So far as I know, he's still out there. Last contact I had with him, he was still drinking. But I took out my Bible in his company. It's the miracle of the 12th step, really. And I know you're supposed to work the steps in order, but gee, every now and again, God is willing to flex a bit. And it was two alcoholics talking about the nature of alcoholism. And in the company of another person who suffered from my illness and who knew what it was like, I was able to be honest, to begin to be honest. And the psychic change began within me. And I took out my Bible and I wrote down, I am an alcoholic, I choose not to drink. And I signed my name and I dated it, and thanks be to God, I haven't had to have a drink for 16 years and some odd months. And then Brian and I kept talking. And he said, well, you've never been able to control your drinking before. What are you going to do when it's a Christmas party, a wedding, a funeral, a baptism, and you know how people love to get priests drinks and see them tipsy? You know, what are you going to say? I said, well, I'll say no. And he said, that's not going to stop them. They're going to ask you again, you know, Father, can I get you something to drink? And I said, well, I'll ask for a Coke or a Pepsi or, you know, soda, whatever. And Brian says, well, they'll say, Father, can I put something in that soda for you? A little rum, vodka. What's that stuff up here? You get a 7 and 7. I said, well, okay, if they won't get me a soda straight up, I'll tell them I'm an alcoholic. I choose not to drink. And Brian said, what if that doesn't stop them? And a grace came to me, which I didn't deserve, and I hadn't prayed for it, and I didn't want it. And I saw, I recognized, my eyes were opened, I had an awakening, right there. I realized anybody who would try to make me drink would have to be an alcoholic. And I said, well, if they keep pushing drink on me, I'll tell them, you're an alcoholic. I'm loaded for bear. And I've never had to reach that point. You know, it's so sad. I didn't know that people were really not interested in what I was drinking. I always thought that was their central concern. It was mine. Why wasn't it theirs? And I get kind of bored at parties nowadays, you know, depending on the people I'm with. And every now and again, I'll kind of slide up to somebody and say, you know, I'm an alcoholic. Just to have something to talk about. I made a terrible mistake. It was easy for me to stop drinking. Not because I deserved it, not because I wanted it. Just luck of the draw. God sending Brian and the pamphlet into my life at the same time. I didn't go to meetings. 3-4 months later, I was in New York City helping out in an infirmary, and there was an old Jesuit there who was not an alcoholic, and I was helping him move from upstairs to downstairs, and this fellow had a whole row of bottles across his bookshelves, and they were full. They were, you know, the little miniatures you used to get on the airplanes for free, and he hadn't even cracked the caps to sniff them. You know, all of the seals were still intact. I can't eat bread without sniffing it, you know. It's just part of the experience. And I realized that this old man probably didn't know how many bottles he had there, and that downstairs it would look different anyway, and that I could grab three in each hand, jump into a closet and chug them, and he would never know the difference. And my hands were itching. My palms were sweating at the prospect of having a drink after 3 months of not drinking. And it frightened me. It terrified me. So I went that day to a fellow Jesuit who was recovering from alcoholism, and I told him my story and explained everything to him. And I was really hoping that Pat would say, "Well, you're not an alcoholic. Go ahead and drink. Enjoy it." Instead, he said, "I'm going to a meeting tonight. Why don't you come along?" He gave me a non-conference approved history of AA that I cherish, this copy of the big book, and the 12 and 12. And I read through the books, enjoyed them very much, marked them all up. And when I went back to Toronto from New York City, I didn't go to any more AA meetings. I met Ray W. at a prayer meeting, and we got to talking about things, and he said he was an alcoholic, and I said, "Yeah, so am I." And he said, "Do you have a sponsor?" And I said, "No." He said, "Well, I'll be your sponsor." And twice a week, for the rest of my first year of sobriety, I'd see him at prayer meetings, and he'd say, "Have you had a drink?" I'd say, "No." He'd say, "How are things going?" I'd tell him. He'd say, "If you ever need anything, anything at all, anytime, day or night, give me a call." After a couple of months of this little routine, he said, "Hi, Marty, how you doing?" "Fine." "Had a drink?" "No." And then he said, "How about them steps?" And I said, "Yeah, I read them." And he said, "Well, how about the fourth and fifth step?" And I said, "I don't have to do that. I'm a priest." That makes me better than most men. "And I'm a Jesuit." Makes me better than most priests. "And I'm a Pentecostal." Hallelujah! That makes me better than most Jesuits. And all I had ever done since applying to be a priest was tell people everything that I had done wrong. I told them my sins with my girlfriends, the abuse I inflicted on my brothers and sisters, physical and mental, stealing, lying, cheating on one French quiz in junior year in high school from Bob Gian's paper. I explored all the details of my shame about my entire sin history, especially the sexual stuff. Not that there was all that much of it, but... it doesn't take much to awaken shame and guilt and to be responsible for making amends. I had listed everything, told the truth as I knew it about myself. So I said to Ray, I've done the fourth and fifth step. Now Ray, simple and a good man, prayerful truck driver, he backed off. He wasn't one of them, you know, black belt step Nazis. the end of my first year of sobriety, he took me to his meeting that he ran in a detox center down in Toronto. And first meeting and only meeting I went to in Toronto in those days. And he gave me a cake and a chip. And a few days later, we were talking. And he said, how are things going? Have you had a drink? No. What's your life like? And I said, you know, Ray, I've been thinking about this anniversary thing, and it's been a year. And I look at my sexual behavior, my relationship with my family and my friends, my prayer life, my studies. They're all still a mess. I thought when you stopped drinking that everything was supposed to get better. Now, this is where your real tough sponsor goes, na 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 na. That's what you get for not working the steps. But I was only going to be in town for a couple of more weeks, and Ray said, well, look, there's no situation so bad that you can't make it worse. By taking a drink. So I stayed dry for another 4 years, restless, irritable, discontent. I switched addictions. I think Johnny said nature abhors a vacuum. I gave up something tremendously important to me and left the hole in my heart empty. I filled it with food and computers and became a complete and utter junkie. I would be on the computer 16, 18, 20 hours a day, 24 hours one Easter, programming, taking apart other people's programs, fixing them, putting them back together, reading manuals for people, teaching them the rules and regulations of the computer world. If any of you have ever come in contact with a computer, you know how much we love to know the rules and regulations, because it makes all the difference. If you don't know the rules and regulations, that machine will not obey you. All the willpower in the world will not communicate to it, turn underlining on. You have to know the key to press. And I wish we had that same hunger and thirst for the handbook, the user's manual in AA. But it kept me busy. And those of you who haven't got any contact with computer addiction, you just won't make sense to you. But when I was on the computer, I was a god. That machine either obeyed me or it got its power cut. And I'd often get up after 16 hours at the computer and say, there's no woman in the world who'd let me punch her buttons for 16 hours. You know? This is... And in the mornings, I'd wake up feeling I'd been through a binge, been through that cycle, and say, well, I'm not going to do that today. And I'd go downstairs and I'd overeat. And I'd say to myself, well, now, it's not good to study on a full stomach. It's liable to hurt my head. I'd better turn on the computer and answer some email. And the morning would vanish. And I'd binge at lunch. Same thing, come back and say, I'll just sit down, fix a few lines of code, the afternoon would vanish. I think some other substitute addictions that people get into are golfing, gardening, playing the horses. Some people in Washington, D.C. would wash their cars meticulously, put this armor all on the tires, play the stock market, sex, pornography. Chewing gum, drinking coffee, tobacco. If you want what we got, you got to do what we do. Drink coffee like a fish and smoke like a chimney. It's easy to take other things and fill that void. Worry, anxiety, control, manipulation, being general service reps, just, what is it, DCM? At the end of this terrible time, the head of my house called me in and said, "How are things going?" And I said, "Well, not too well." And he said, "You're on that computer a lot. Are you using it for your studies?" I said, "No." He said, "You're like an alcoholic with that computer." And I said, "I am an alcoholic. But I'm not drinking. So what's your problem?" You know? And he said, "Well, you should go to AA. They've got this slogan about first things first." So I started going to AA meetings 13 miles away from my house in Laurel, Maryland. And I would go in and say, "I'm Marty Maleski. I'm an alcoholic and my computer is unmanageable." And they directed me to a recovering Jesuit alcoholic down in southern Maryland at Faulkner Retreat House. And I did an 8-day retreat with him. First 3 days, it was a women's retreat, and he told me to sit way up in the back in the choir loft, and that the women would never notice that I was there. And then each talk, he'd say hi to the bearded lady. And about the third or fourth day of this 8-day retreat, after he'd listened to me talk about my sorrows, he said, you know what's wrong with you? You haven't worked the fourth and fifth step." And I had an awakening. And I knew he was right. I didn't understand then why he was right, but I knew he was right. And I said, "Oh, John, yes, I'm ready. I'm willing to work the fourth and fifth step. I got 5 days left. Let's do it this week and get it over with." He said, "5 days? That's not enough. Come back in a couple of months." So September 3rd, 1986, early in the morning, I went back to Faulkner and I did my first fifth step. I did not do a searching and fearless moral inventory. I did what I was capable of. Full of fear, anxiety, regret. Just skimmed the surface. And at the end of that hour and a half of talking with him, two things happened. I felt an amazing sense of solidarity with AA and an overwhelming sense of superiority. There are two kinds of people in AA, those who have done the fifth step and those who lie about it. And I was ready to take my place at the tables. And the other thing that happened was that John took my inventory, and he had a little ritual, and he burned it. And I still haven't forgiven him for that. Because Bill says in the eighth step, "Now take up the things that you learned in the fourth step." And I had to start over. I had to redo my fourth step. I've done it many times since, and I know that some people don't think you can do more than one fourth and fifth step, and if that's the case, then I've been doing a lot of tenth steps, because I've continued to take personal inventory. And when I'm wrong, whenever I get an awakening that shows me another area where God is trying to change my psyche, I try to admit it as soon as I can. And I've done more than a dozen surveys of my life, inventories, and shared them with sponsors in different 12-step programs, different cities I've lived in, at different times, for different purposes. Something comes up. And I believe these are the great healing steps for our mental illness. 4 through 9, they're the complete package of what we need to reverse the damage done to us by our habit of denial, by our abuse of alcohol, by our abuse of those who loved us and whom we were called to love. These are the steps that clear away the wreckage of the past. If you've done them, I hope that you will continue to use these principles in all of your affairs. If you haven't done them, I urge you to embark upon them generously. Surrender yourself to God, the God of your understanding, who loves you and who hates to see you suffering from the remnants of this mental illness. It's good to be sober. I don't regret and I don't discount my 5 years of not drinking. They matter to me. They created the conditions under which I eventually could feel my feelings, pain, anguish, despair, shame, regret, and take healing action with those feelings, giving them to a God who loves me and who tosses all the wreckage into the trash bin. And though my sins are red as scarlet, he makes me white as snow. I've been born again through Alcoholics Anonymous, through the steps. I love you so much, and thank you for letting me share this today.